Daily Service, led by the Reverend Andrew Martlew. You're listening to Radio 4 FM, where we begin a new Book of the Week. Doubling back is author Linda Cracknell's account of walking in the footsteps of others. In today's episode, dancing, kicking up her legs, Linda visits the landscape beloved of the Scottish writer Jessie Kesson. The reader is Teresa Gallagher.
The first time I remember striking out alone on a journey, I can't have been more than about 4 years old. Yet many of the elements of my adult walking are reflected in it. There was something deliberate about it, a necessary adventure which changed my relationship to a landscape. After the death of my father, Richard, in 1961, my mother moved my older sister, brother and myself to a Surrey suburb. I was under two, and the garden became my habitat. It was where I went by choice, but also where I was banished. My mother would turn the key on the inside while she washed the kitchen floor. In memory, although we disagree about this now, the key then stayed turned for much of the day. My first solo journey wasn't exactly a walk, but rather a crawl on hands and knees, from one boundary fence to the other at the bottom of the garden. Some impulse sent me trailblazing a tunnel through a forest of sappy bracken. My hands dragged through leaf mould and I disturbed dark smells, slugs and worms. I pressed on, despite slow progress, determined to reach my destination. In memory, the journey took a long morning. When I completed the expedition, I recall a sense of achievement. A new, braver me had emerged at the other end. Supposedly I often disappeared like this, only traceable by the quiver of bracken fronds, and emerging muddy and beetle-infested a few hours later. I learnt about my need to discover, got the dirt of the place under my fingernails, and found self-reliance and independence there. I've remained both a daily walker and an expedition walker. The walks in this collection are mostly retreadings of past trails, either taken by myself or others. In the act of doubling back, I discover what remains or is new, and listen for memories, some of which have become buried. The first of these walks takes me to places significant in the early life of the writer Jessie Kesson, landscapes that inspired her later texts. A hillside near Abriachan, Loch Ness. Despite late April sunshine, spring was still holding its breath when I arrived on her hillside. I was 1,000 feet up at Abriachan, where a dormer-windowed house straddles lush pastureland below and the scratch of heather on the open moor above. This is Achbuie, where, at the age of 19, Jessie Kesson, 1916 to 1994, came after a year of virtual imprisonment in a mental hospital. She was boarded out, as the practice was known, living with and helping an elderly woman on her croft, on a hill so high and steep that, as she said, you feel any moment you might topple into Loch Ness below. She rambled freely for the 6 months or so that she stayed. The visceral thrill of the place in springtime pulses through her writing ever after. I wanted to share her exuberance and find the red rock she wrote about, a slash of steep gully sliced inland from the loch into a south-facing cliff. I knew that, as Jessie ran and rambled across the hillside here, she was followed by a stream of younger girls intrigued by her supposed experience. Rites of passage were played out here. A childish game came close to an early sexual adventure. Later, her courtship with her future husband, John Kesson, who quarried the Red Sand Rock, involved meetings on Sunday afternoons. Lying in the shadow of the Red Rock, they used the book, which she was required to carry on the Sabbath, as a pillow. That day in late April, I climbed above the Red Rock to where the open moor levels. I savoured the long views that Jessie wrote of in Eye to the Hills, through a character called Chris. High up in the shadow of the red rock she would lie, knowing that never in a lifetime could she absorb the changing moods and varying beauty of the vista unfolded below her. To the northeast, the Moray Firth and the sea's horizon sparkled. The lure that perhaps took the young Jessie away to Inverness, next returning to Abriachan for her honeymoon, and repeatedly afterwards in words. Jessie Kesson was born illegitimate and lived in the Elgin slums with her mother, who recited 19th century poetry as they walked barefoot through the countryside. Her mother was a drinker and a small-time prostitute, and Jessie was eventually taken away from her to live in an orphanage. Unable to continue her education, despite excellence at school, she took on various unsatisfactory jobs, performing poorly because she was enticed away by the outdoors, or lost in a book of poetry while the ironing scorched. At the age of 18, she spent a year in Aberdeen Royal Mental Hospital, following an attack on the matron of the girls' hostel, who had implied a slur on her mother. Despite such early experiences, she became famous in her lifetime, with two novels becoming feature films, including Another Time, Another Place. But it was writing for radio in which she was most prolific and successful. Ironically, it was success in this medium, ephemeral, unarchived, largely unpublished, that now unjustly might allow her work to fade. On my second visit, I take the sunny slopes below Achbuie rather than the moor bristling above. The cropped greenness of the pasture invites me to run in Julie Andrews' gladness, a child again. It's here that I imagine Jessie making her own plunge to the lochside, in a joyful errand to meet the van that was the grocer, butcher and draper combined, to which she carried eggs in return for the messages. I imagine her singing and laying her feet to a tune as she went. Perhaps it would be like the dance music heard by Isabel in Where the Apple Ripens, following her all the way to Corby's Wood and echoing through her mind long after she had reached home. I sit on damp grass near Balmore. Birdsong bubbles in a galaxy around my head. Long buzzard mules stretch high notes above me, against the lighter chips, trills and warbles of stonechats, skylarks and meadow pipits. The passing buzz of a bee. An aeroplane drones from one side of the loch to the other, its hum eclipsed behind the rocky knoll above Achbuie. Then a crack of sound springs my eyes open as a jet banks behind my shoulder, tilts low over the loch. It's as if spring has lofted everything skywards. Soft, unexplained pops rise from the grass. On this north-facing slope, bracken heads have broken through the turf, heads still curled tight. They look strong and fleshy, but innocent, belying their summer rampancy. Bracken, as Jessie pointed out, is called in Gaelic the lovely curse. Few plants can compete with it, fending off predators as it does with an arsenal of chemical weapons, including cyanide. The smell of spring in the hills is a blending of peaty thickness, bracken mould, flowers' spiciness, and clean, quick purge of the wind, Jessie wrote in the Scots magazine. And her scents are all here. It's the gorse that beguiles me to stop with its coconut-scented panting. In Gaelic, the name for gorse comes from the word for wrangle or quarrel. And like a brassy blonde wearing gold jewellery, she's here in a tussle with those around her, draining colour from the exuberant birch leaves, the loch below and the bluebells. But perhaps you're allowed to be a bit showy in spring. Sure of Jessie's route down the burn, I follow a fence tented by a crisp brown cover of last year's bracken. Down I go into the shade of coppiced hazel woods. I hear the burn chittering on my right as I tumble out onto the steep tarmac lane that climbs to Abriachan from the loch. It's breezeless and shaded. I cross the burn, wondering where Jessie would have found the next part of her descent. And there is a gate, and a path marked by a scattered line of brown leaves leading down between the trees. I walk slowly for fear of missing something. The Lochside clamour starts to penetrate the woodland. Motorbikes have been sprung from winter garages to roar along the A82. Through the trees, I glimpse the white wake pulled behind a tourist boat. Would Jessie have been running at this point towards the grocer's van, despite the egg she holds? The sense of a well-loved path keeps pulling me lochwards, to a wicket gate in an unyielding high fence. Beyond it, I see the purple flash of rhododendron, hints of laid paths, ponds and house roofs. I skirt the fence looking for another way, smashing through bramble and brush. My legs are scratched and bloody, torn by the open edges of dead bracken stem. With soil and moss smearing my hands, I'm returned to my childhood garden, my wilderness of bracken. Then I'm out onto the A82, shuddered by the windsuck of juggernaut, bike, van. I cross to the pink shingle shore onto which vast waters splash. A heavy afternoon sky brings a few drops of rain from the south. The loch sucks at the shore. I think of Kesson's descriptions of walking to church along this shore, but having to stick to the road on a Sunday rather than scooshing through the soft white sand by the loch side, laughing and talking with those of her own age, once they were far enough ahead of the adults. This rattling chatter seemed to mark her time here too, despite her sense of being an outsider wherever she went, an ootling, as she called it, marching to a different beat from other people. I like this Scots word, ootling, the territory of the writer, perhaps. As a shy child, I always felt on the edge, peering in, choosing friends who are also outsiders, alienated by obesity, religion, or other kinds of oddness. My mother's attempts to integrate me with other children by enrolling me at Brownies or in a summer holiday club at the local park both ended before they began, with her driving me away again, crying. I retreated to my garden refuge, where there were acorns to gather and serve to my dolls at mealtimes. I could dig for treasures and inhabit my own world. When she was staying at the girls' hostel in Aberdeen, Jessie wrote of an association between spring and rebellion. It was only when I began to break a rule that the girls began to accept me and confided in me. But I didn't break the rule for that reason. It was broken for no reason that I can give words to. I'd smelt the spring, a different thing altogether from knowing it was there. I smelt it almost before it came, as if it had told me it was coming. It's clear that the hillside at Abriachan remains special to Jessie. She chose it for her honeymoon. She chose it as the place where her ashes were to be scattered. A hillside so alive to her that she returned to it again and again in her writing. Perhaps from the rootlessness of her childhood years, she found some sense of security here in proximity to nature. As I turn away from the loch and begin the climb back, I feel that today I've brushed shoulders with a character who, by her own admission, was like a tornado at 19 when she whirled into the life of the old lady at Achbuey, making her ask, "Is there no settle in you?" Jessie's granddaughter described how her grandmother would be remembered. Dancing, kicking up her legs. And it seems an apt description also for this hillside in springtime.
And Teresa Gallagher continues her reading of Doubling Back by Linda Cracknell at the same time tomorrow. The book is abridged by Sian Preece and produced by Gaynor McFarlane.
The leading Brazilian social scientist, Gilberto Freire,
a country's love affair with the beautiful game,
said this about his nation's football. Our style seems to contrast to the European style because of a set of characteristics, such as surprise, and I shall say, individual brilliance and spontaneity.
For BBC Radio 4, David Goldblatt presents The History of Brazil is Round.
That's something which is related to dance, to capoeira, which rounds and sweetens the game the British invented.
All this week at 1:45.